Good afternoon. I want to make sure I mention that this particular session is the result of a very generous gift and part of an endowment called the Danny and Carol Phillips Distinguished Speaker Series for the Pepperdine Bible Lectures 2017. So we translated that yesterday to tell Suzanne, or remind Suzanne, that she is bona fide.
Yeah. Which just put me one more step closer to trouble.
If you were not in this session yesterday, obviously you'll have time in the coming weeks to catch up through the university podcast system. But we've tried to stagger these so that these stand alone. So I don't want you at all to feel like, well, if I miss yesterday and I don't know if I can come tomorrow, or I know I can come tomorrow, but these are standalones. But there's an article released just today in GQ about Brad Pitt. Has anyone seen it?
Is that the one where he talks about how much he likes my work?
Yeah, that's right. He references the work of Suzanne Stabile in GQ. Yeah. So I was hoping that no one had read it, because it triggered in me something powerful this morning as I'm reading it. This last year in the local church where I serve, my elders asked me to do a very intentional review in terms of my sabbatical coming up. I have a sabbatical coming up this summer. And so they wanted me to think about the last 8 years and my work and how I spend my time and what's good and what's not good and what gives life and what doesn't give life and all of that. And this past year, I counted approximately that I did about 500 hours of pastoral care. We're a church of about 1,800 people, and I'm the preacher, so in some ways I get default drama because I'm the guy they have to listen to every week, right? Hey, you tell us stories about your kid, you got to listen to my drama. That's the deal, man. Right? That's the trade-off. So what happens when you do that much pastoral care with people? It's not counseling, because I'm not trained to do that. It's genuinely pastoral care. It's spiritual listening. But what happens when you do that amount of time is you see patterns. And you know where stories are going before they know where the stories are going. And one of the things that I learned this last year about myself and that I learned about the people in our church is that everything that people said about postmodernism is true. That very few of us, are living out of one dominant story. Most of us are doing quilt patchwork. And we're taking a story from here, and 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 we're just trying to hold it all together. And if you want a really painful example of that, read the Brad Pitt GQ article, because he is incredibly transparent about the train wreck that he finds himself in right now. And nothing but love and compassion, but also it's piercing. And that's part of the reason that Suzanne and I wanted to shape these 3 days the way that we are. If you were in here for the conversation about the shack, I mean, the conversation, it's just a river. It just flows right into the next. So we started yesterday by saying that we are the stories we tell ourselves. And that part of spiritual health, whether you're Jew, Christian, Baha'i, Muslim, wherever you are in that walk, that figuring out the stories that you privilege is a key step in not only just being a great person, but also being a person who has something to contribute in your marriage, in your parenting, in the place that you work, where you find yourself. And so the life's work is soul work. Like that's our real calling, is to constantly be aware and attuned to our inner struggles. And I know for some of you that sounds new agey. And I'm okay with that. I used to try and like fight you on that, and I'm like, that's okay if you think that's new agey. But I think that's part of what Jesus meant when he said the kingdom of God. Because part of the time he taught about the kingdom of God, he said, it's within you. It's all around you. And of course, the kingdom is concerned with global matters and national matters and city matters, of course. But the focus of this 3 days is that we talk a lot about the Jesus Creed, loving God and loving others, but you can't love God and love others if you don't love yourself. And you just have to get over it. We have to learn how to love ourselves, how to be kind to ourselves, how to be generous to ourselves, how to tell ourselves the truth. That's part of loving ourselves. So we're committed over these 3 days to telling the truth. And Suzanne was courageous yesterday by telling us some of the most intimate parts of her story. Not just so that you would love her and know her story, but so that you could also start to turn in on your own story. And you gave us a homework assignment yesterday. So let's welcome back Suzanne Stibiel.
Thank you. I want to take care of a little bit of business because I always forget business once I start telling stories. For those of you who are from this area, I'm teaching an Enneagram Know Your Number workshop at First Congregational Church in L.A. on August the 25th and 26th, Friday night and all day Saturday. So y'all come. I'm in Austin, for if you're in that part of the country, next weekend at Westover Hills Church on Friday night and Saturday, teaching a Know Your Number workshop. So I'm not going to talk much about the Enneagram, and yet I talk always about the Enneagram because the Enneagram is all about how we see. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how we see. So I want to start by saying that I think the greatest form or offering of hospitality is telling your story. It is the best gift that you have to offer other people. And one of the questions that you have to ask yourself on a regular basis when you're looking at your story is you got to stop sometimes and think about the story that you're telling yourself, because that's the one you're going to tell other people, or that's the one you're going to refuse to tell other people. And when you think about the story that you're telling yourself, then you need to stop and you need to ask these two questions. Is it true? And then after you've asked if it's true, you need to ask, is it really true? Because your first answer will be yes. And then the other thing that you need to do is you need to get to a place where you ask how your life would change if you told yourself a different story. So there are two ways of introducing me. I'm introduced almost weekly by people who talk about me as an Enneagram master teacher and talk about me in terms of relationships, talk about me in terms of the work I do in the world with veterans or in the recovery community or wherever, and people say lovely things about me. And they're true, for the most part. And then there's this other way of introducing myself, which is, hi, my name's Suzanne, and I was adopted at birth. I was sexually abused by the family I lived with as a foreign exchange student at 16. I gained weight then and never lost it. I went to SMU. I married the wrong person. I'm divorced. I'm married to a former Catholic priest. We have lived our life together. We have four beautiful children who get it right and who get it wrong. And that's also all true. And there are stories that go with all of that. And when you limit yourself to either introduction, then not only do other people not know who you are, but you don't know who you are either. And frankly, depending on your Enneagram number, you limit yourself to the bright and shiny introduction or to the here's where I missed the mark introduction. And then depending on the Enneagram number of the people you're talking to, they respond with a similar or dissimilar introduction. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that sexual abuse. Wait. How many of you weren't here yesterday? Oh, I've got a treat for you. The best person I know is in the room, and I happen to be married to him. So you guys meet my husband, Joe Stibiel. I always introduce him whether he's with me or whether he's not with me, because he's the best person I know. He helps me be the best person I can be. And it would be a treat for you to know him for 5 minutes or 5 days. So there's the guy right there. And I'm just kind of in his shadow trying to be faithful. So at 16, my dad's a doc and a Rotarian. And the Rotary Club had a big summer exchange program. And I applied, and I was chosen to be an exchange student. And I went to Sweden for the summer to live with a doctor and his family. And my parents also traveled that summer. And so my contact, my way of getting in touch with them was three times removed because of where they were in the world and where I was in the world. And this doctor had his practice in Stockholm, but they had a home on the island of Fjällbacka. And to make a long story short, after I'd been in Sweden about a month, we went to Fjällbacka. And they spoke Swedish most of the time. I spoke no Swedish. And it was explained to me in English that the best way for me to get to Fjällbacka was to go on the boat with the father and his two sons. And they sexually abused me the whole way. So it's a horrific story, and there are lots of scars from that story. And it could have determined the rest of my life. And if I told you the details, it would break your heart. That is my story with me as a victim of sexual abuse. But what I want you to know is that there are always two ways for you to tell your story. And one is as the victim, and one is as the victor. And if you have a habit of just telling your story one way or the other, then you need to get with a good friend, and you need to tell them your story with you as the victim and with you as the victor. So, for me as the victor, now y'all remember I'm Methodist, so that gives me a little bit of license, right? and I want to be honest because we agreed to that. So, here's what I want you to know. Because my parents recognized that I needed help once I started having flashbacks, and my parents were able to get me good therapy. I was in therapy for 7 years, at first three times a week. And because of that blessing and because of a good therapist, I was able to have four children with no complications at all. I'm married to a really great guy, and to be honest, we have a very healthy sex life. Part of that has to do with the fact that he was celibate till he was 40. It changes things, is all I can tell you. So what I want you to know is that whatever your story is, you can tell it with you as the victim, or you can tell it with you as the victor. And I'm encouraging both, not the victor story by itself. Because if you can't own the first, you can't own the second. So when Josh and I were texting back and forth about how we might use this time, you need to know that my normal teaching time is 8 hours. So Josh reiterated over and over that I had this little tiny bit of time. And he said, you know, I might like to hear you talk about stories that include what breaks your heart or what makes you angry or what makes you afraid or what causes you to go numb. So I thought, okay, I'll just go with those. So I'm going to start with what breaks your heart. Part of what breaks my heart, you're young enough to do this, is I'm 66, and if I come around here and pick up these glasses that somebody dropped on the floor, it's going to be a terrible experience for everybody in the room. For those of you who know the Enneagram, I'm a 2, and that was just me being helpful to some stranger that I don't know. All right. So here's what breaks my heart. The suicide rate and suicide ideation among young adults is increasing exponentially. Now, that's how people sometimes tell a story. And here's my way of telling that story. I pretty much thought that Joe and I were prepared for everything. We'd both taught in high school. We both spent a lot of time on college campuses. I was a college coach. We weren't naive. about what our children might or might do or not do or fall prey to. And our oldest son, as a sophomore in college, got addicted to internet gambling. And he was playing around with it his freshman year. By his sophomore year, he was in pretty deep. By his junior year, he called us right before Christmas and said, "I'm bringing everything home because you're not going to let me come back to school because I haven't been to class." So he came home, and we let him live with us for 90 days. And he kind of started a life, and he had a job, and he went to Gamblers Anonymous a couple of times, and then we kind of thought things were getting better, and he asked to borrow some money from us. We loaned it to him with a payback time, and he paid it back. And then that repeated itself a second time a few months later. And our rule is 3 strikes and you're out. So we said, you're 2 strikes down. If you come back to us asking for a loan, we're not going to give it to you. So you need to know that up front. So he came, went to his sister's, and they didn't loan him any money, and he needed $200 for his rent. And he had worked at the same hamburger place for 5 or 6 summers, and he decided that he would just go there. He knew how to get in and where the money was and how to get in the cash register and everything, and he'd just steal $200. So he did that, but with a little flair, he did it with a water gun. And somebody who didn't know him called the police, and he ran, and they chased him. And to make a long story short, he ended up in the Dallas County Jail for 90 days. And ultimately got out and worked for a year and went to trial and had to go to boot camp for 6 months. And then try to put life together with a felony. And that's not easy to do. But he did pretty good. And we had a 4th of July family party, and on our way home, Joe and I said, "You know, I think Joel's doing really well." And the next afternoon, his girlfriend called us because she couldn't get him on his phone. And by the time we were in on knowing what was happening, he had already been taken by ambulance to the hospital, and he had slit his wrist from here to here. Now, I thought that I was ready for whatever might come. That thought had never crossed my mind. Never one time had I ever thought, even for a moment, that our child might try to commit suicide. So, because of the work I do, we always have scholarships. And a guy who is aware of our work and had come to do some work with me at our center in Dallas to learn the Enneagram, to use it in a recovery work. We didn't know who to call, so we called him. And we had been around the block enough to know that Joel needed a 90-day treatment facility. Everybody does, by the way, who's addicted. But we were going to really try for 90 days, but nobody had insurance. So if you don't know this, a 90-day treatment facility is $90,000 because it's $1,000 a day. And we're in ministry, so you do know about that. So Todd said, "Give me 30 minutes. And he called us back in 30 minutes and said, "I've called the owners, and we have a 90-day scholarship for Joel." Now, that could be a story that you could tell that could just be the end. It'd be so great, right? Except that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are struggling with addiction who can't call the owner or have somebody call the owner and get a $90,000 scholarship. And so we know that we're blessed, and we know that we have work to do. And, you know, one of the stories that you just don't think you're going to tell is our son tried to commit suicide. And most people whose children try to commit suicide don't tell that story. In fact, what we've learned in the last 4 or 5 years is that many high school and college kids who commit suicide, their parents cover that with she was killed in a car wreck or some other big story that covers the truth. So Joel's good. He's working for us full-time in Life in the Trinity Ministry, and he's doing well. Do all of you know about the Semicolon Project? Raise your hand if you do know. Everybody else in the room, please Google the Semicolon Project. Essentially, it's a project that was started by a young woman who said you can put a semicolon instead of a period and keep going. And she committed suicide 2 months ago. But y'all don't ever, nobody wears stoles, right, Josh? Y'all don't ever wear stoles? Well, I guess you're going to have to get a tattoo then. Because I'm encouraging clergy everywhere I go that wears stoles to have a semicolon embroidered on their stole. And I'm hearing story after story after story back from those clergy who have done that because young adults are coming up to them after worship to talk about suicide ideation. So I would encourage you to figure out a way to work that into. You can just put a big old semicolon in your bulletin or do something. Okay, now let's think. I'm only one going to talk. Let's think for 1 second about the difference in what breaks my heart is suicide ideation in so many young people. What breaks my heart is that my son tried to commit suicide. My son's doing well because we got a 90-day scholarship. What breaks my heart is all the people who need 90 days in treatment who can't get it. What makes you angry? I'm a big one for spiritual practices. I don't know if that's because I'm married to a former priest who lives by a spiritual discipline and spiritual practices. There's an old saint, Teresa of Avila, who writes about the fact that her spiritual practices led her to create inside of herself an interior castle where she can go and be with God. And I don't have a castle. Joe's got a castle. I have an efficiency apartment. But it's good. It's a good one. And it's a place where I stop before I act and think and breathe and decide and listen. And it's a good thing, that spiritual practice. But I have a variety of other spiritual practices as well. So in Dallas, there is a pastor of a denomination other than yours or mine who has a big steeple church and big congregation. And I don't agree with him on much of anything. And I don't like him. And he makes me angry because I think he's narrow-minded and not very smart and mean-spirited. And so for 5 years, every Sunday morning, I listened to him preach at the early service before I went to my church to teach Sunday school and listen to my preacher. And I have broken several hair dryers by just throwing them across the room. I have said things that I hope I never say in front of other people about him. I just can hardly bear listening to him. He makes me so angry. But until I can invite him to go to lunch with me and not need him to believe what I believe, I'm him. Right? So that's what makes me angry. Here's what makes me afraid. You know, I love teaching everywhere I get to teach. I love folks, and I love getting to know people, and I love teaching. I didn't expect my experience on college campuses teaching to be exactly what it's turned out to be. And the two things that I've picked up from students on college campuses that I have taken with me and found out that they apply pretty much to all of us are that there are two things that everybody wants. And one of those is everybody wants to belong. Every single human being wants to belong. And I got to tell you, I'm not sure we're doing a good job at that in the church. I'm just not sure. And I'm not sure Jesus likes that. That we're not doing a good job with that. And everybody wants their life to have meaning. And I'm pretty worried about the fact that to have both of those things, for some people, seems like an impossibility. I'm never going to belong, really belong. If you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. If you knew who I really am, you wouldn't want to be with me. I'm not going to belong here, and I want to, but maybe I can belong there, but I don't really want to belong there. I want my life to have some kind of meaning. I'll just tell you, your life's not going to have any meaning until you find a belonging system. Because you only belong as you understand belonging. I mean, you only have meaning as you understand meaning in relation to other people. So I think we got to build some belonging systems within all of our denominations. And that's a common theme no matter what denomination I'm speaking to. And I'm actually afraid when I think about how many people come to me and tell me that they don't think their life has meaning or they don't feel like they belong anywhere. I taught last weekend at Christ Church in Nashville. And it was quite something to be at that church, and to be there for worship was quite something. And the setup was like this, only pews, and they're higher, and there were more. And I wanted to sit where I could hear our friend Hunter preach and see him and send him little signals about how much I love him, which I'm sure he's just dying for. But as we walked in, we entered on this side, and then we came down and walked all the way over to where Josh is to sit. And we walked by this first group, and everybody's in front of me. A friend of Hunter's is right in front of me. And I said, "Darren, that was Sandy Patty." And he turned back and he said, "That is Sandy Patty." So I kept walking, and I sat down. And I looked over, and Sandy Patty had been really good to our son BJ when he was a little bitty boy. He sang with the Texas Boys Choir, and she was one of his favorite musicians along with the Gaithers, and he loved hearing her sing, and we got a pass to go backstage, and she was really good to him, and she let him sing for her. So I thought, you know, we got a few minutes. I'm just going to go back over there and thank her. It's been 15 years. I'm just going to go back over there and thank her. So on my way over there, my friend Hunter's sister is in front of Sandy Patty, and she stands up and opens her arms, and I hug her, and she hugs me, and I said, "It's so good to see you, and I'm so glad you're going to dedicate the baby today, and I'm so glad that I got to be here for that." And then Amanda, who's one of the musicians' wives, who we love a lot, was there, and I hugged Amanda, and I said, "I'm so glad to see you. How are the babies?" And then Sandy Patty said, Excuse me, are you Suzanne Stabile?" I said, "Uh-huh." She said, "That voice. I would recognize your voice anywhere." I said, "Really?" She said to her husband, Honey, listen to this voice. Say something, Suzanne." So I said, "Hi, honey, I'm Suzanne." He said, "It's the voice." So I'm all flustered and a little nervous. And she said, "We've been on tour. We're all listening to you in the back of the bus. I feel like I know you, and you've changed our life." Okay, now, let me just ask you. If the story started, Suzanne Stabile walked into her room, and Sandy Patty walked into her room, and somebody said, "That voice." Whose voice would you think they were talking about? Sandy Patty's, right? And just the day before in the workshop, the guy who plays the organ at this church said, "You know, one of the things I really struggle with is people keep coming up to me and talking to me about how talented I am, but they say they don't have a talent. That they don't have any talent. They can't play musical instruments. They can't sing. They can't paint. They can't do anything. And I just don't know how to teach them that they can." And that story ran through my head as I walked across the room. And I thought, Sandy Patty maybe has one of the best known voices anywhere, at least in Christian communities. And for her to recognize me by my voice meant that I have a responsibility. That I have a responsibility to do what I'm put here to do and use my voice to do it. So after worship, I kind of looked over there. You know, you kind of look across the room and think, I wonder if I'll ever see her again. And I'm talking to somebody else, and she starts running across the front of the church, and she said, "I just have to hug you one more time. You have changed my life." Now, I think we need to pay attention to the fact that what we're afraid of in terms of anonymity is unlikely. And whether or not we believe our life has meaning and the things we're doing have meaning, they do. And we have to do what's ours to do. And your story's not the same as mine, and my story's not the same as Sandy Patty's. But they don't have different values. And we need to be aware of that as we write our stories. What causes you to go numb? I thought about that for a long time. And I think there are things that have caused me to go numb, but the biggest is probably, if I put it all under one heading, the biggest thing that causes me to go numb, I think, is rewriting history. And I want to talk to you guys so much, and I have so little time, so I don't want to read to you. But I'm telling you, in the last 2 years, I've learned you can't take other people's stories and make them yours. Your stories are yours, and you got to tell them. And when other people tell your stories, or when you tell other people's stories, it doesn't work quite as well. Because there's a disconnect there. And rewriting history, nobody tells a better story about that than Sylvia Boorstein. And just to get you, to get your attention, she's a Jewish Buddhist. So you can think about that after I'm done. You know, I want to start by saying I think it's very, very difficult to keep the emotions of the present moment from rewriting history. Say that again. I think it's very difficult for us to keep the emotions from the present moment from rewriting history. Whether or not we are angry or insulted or embarrassed, we're tempted to rewrite. And this is going to be, if I do my best, 3 minutes and 45 seconds because I had Joe time it so I'd know how much I was sacrificing for a Jewish Buddhist. All right, here we go. A woman I met recently on the New Englander, the train that begins in New Hampshire and passes through western Massachusetts on its way to Philadelphia, might have, but didn't, rewrite her history. There were very few people on the train when I boarded it in Springfield. I noticed one couple, clearly older than I am by a significant number of years, sitting together in the last row, holding hands. I immediately imagined a history for them. More than 50 years married, several children, many grandchildren. I noticed as I settled into a seat some rows before them that they weren't talking to each other, and I wondered whether when Seymour and I have been together 50 years, we too will have run out of things to say. My habit on long train rides is to get up from my seat periodically and walk back and forth up the length of the car several times, just to stretch. On my second or third stretch break, the woman smiled at me, and I stopped to talk. They were still holding hands. "Are you going all the way to Philadelphia?" I asked. "We are," the woman answered. "Do you live there?" I asked. "Are you going home?" The man spoke. "No," he said. "We live in New Hampshire, but I need a certain surgery that they do only at one particular hospital in Philadelphia. We're going there." I thought about how wonderful it was that these two old people, having been together so long, were now able to face old age challenges together. "How long have you been married?" I asked. I wanted to give them the pleasure of telling me, and anyway, I wanted to know. "We're not married," the woman replied. "We just met each other 3 years ago. We live together." I tried not to look surprised. Then they both told me their stories. The man told his story first. He had married young. His wife had died 7 years previously. They'd had 5 children. His grandchildren were grown. His children still lived in New Hampshire, but most of his grandchildren lived farther away. Many of them came back every summer for a family reunion. And then the woman told her story, and she said, "I was a bit older when I married than he was. I had 4 children right away, each a year apart from the next. My husband and I raised them all," she continued, "and they all got married. And then after 44 years, after all that, I came home one day and found a note from my husband that he'd left with another woman. That was 3 years ago, and I was furious. I'm sure you can imagine." I tried to imagine. I thought about 2 mismatched people struggling through so many years trying to raise their family. "It must have been a really bad 44 years, I ventured, half question, half answer. I mainly was aiming for a sympathetic tone as a response to her disclosure of having been furious. "Not at all," she answered. "It was the best 44 years of my life. We had a good time together. We had great children. His business did fine. We all went on holidays together. It was fine. And then he got this nonsense going." She stopped in mid-sentence and waved one hand at the wrist as if to brush the story away. "It's all right now," she said. "I run into him all the time. Just this morning we passed him at the train station as we were getting on the train." And then she asked why I was going to Philadelphia. "I'm going to teach," I said. I knew she had seen me riding at my seat as she passed me on her trips through the car. "I write books about having a good attitude, and I'll probably write a story about you." She looked puzzled. "What good attitude?" she said. "I just told you I was furious." "But you didn't let the furiousness leak out over your whole life," I offered, feeling a bit awkward. I'd been trying to compliment her for making a wise choice between 2 possible attitude options, one skillful and one not, and apparently the unwise one, the one that would not have been truthful or helpful, hadn't even appeared on her radar. "You could have continued to be mad at him," I said, "mad that he left you. You could have resented the 44 years. "No, I couldn't," she said. "At the end there, it was rough, but they were the best years of my life. That's the truth." That's tricky. I have to have my notes because then I'll tell you some story I don't have planned and you won't get to go where you're going next and be a mess. So, you can't rewrite the past regardless of the emotions of the present, because then you're not being true to yourself or to your own story. And you can't tell other people's stories as if they're your own, because they're not your stories. And if you start telling other people's stories, they don't get to tell them themselves. And then finally, I think I'm going to make it. I want to tell you about Dominique Voyome. I was reminded again today, we had lunch with some old friends and some new friends, and I was reminded again today that we are losing opportunities to get to know one another as we are. We know what people do, but we don't know what they believe. We know how people make money, but we don't know what they use it for. We know either where people are successful without knowing about their failures, or we know about their failures without knowing about where they're successful. And I think often, is there anything beyond all of these stories? The ones we tell, the ones we don't tell. What's the story beyond the story? Brennan Manning was, for a time, a Catholic priest. He left the priesthood and he was an alcoholic his whole life. If you've never read anything of his, I would so encourage you to. And if you're going to start with something, start with Abba's Child. And I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs from Abba's Child. Brennan Manning was a worker priest, and I don't talk about that very well. I don't usually get it right, but worker priests were from one order, but different. Were they? How many? Talk real fast. I got 4 minutes.
It's in France. Different priests from all over, different countries, trained together to live together and work in factories.
Did you get that? In France, priests from all countries came together and lived together and worked in factories. So they're representing who God is to folks who are doing everyday factory work. The breakfast table talk grew animated when our discussion turned to our daily employment. The German brother remarked that our wages were substandard, 60 cents per hour. I commented that our employers were never seen in the parish church on Sunday morning. The French brother suggested that this showed hypocrisy. The Spanish brother said they were rude and greedy. The tone grew more caustic and the salvos got heavier. We concluded that our avarice bosses were nasty, self-centered cretins who slept all day Sunday and never once lifted their minds and hearts in thanksgiving to God. Dominique sat at the end of the table. Throughout our harangue, he never opened his mouth. I glanced down the table and saw tears rolling down his cheeks. "What's the matter, Dominique?" I asked. His voice was barely audible, and all he said was, "They don't understand." How many times since that New Year's morning has that single sentence of his turned resentment of mine into compassion? How often have I reread the passion story of Jesus in the Gospels through the eyes of Dominique Voyome? Seeing Jesus in the throes of his death agony, beaten and bullied, scourged and spat upon, saying, "Father, forgive them. They don't understand." The following year, Dominique, a lean, muscular 6'2", always wearing a navy blue beret, learned at age 54 that he was dying of inoperable cancer. With the community's permission, he moved to a poor neighborhood in Paris and took a job as a night watchman at a factory. Returning home every morning at 8 a.m., he would go directly to a little park across the street from where he lived and sit down on a wooden bench. Hanging around the park were marginal people, drifters and winos and has-beens, and dirty old men who eyed the girls passing by. Dominique never criticized or scolded or reprimanded them. He laughed, told stories, shared his candy, accepted them just as they were. From living so long out of the inner sanctuary, he gave off a peace, a serene sense of self-possession and a hospitality of heart that caused cynical young men and defeated old men to gravitate toward him like bacon toward eggs. His simple witness lay in accepting others as they were without questions and allowing them to make themselves at home in his heart. Dominique was the most non-judgmental person I've ever known. He loved with the heart of Jesus Christ. One day when the ragtag group of rejects asked him to talk about himself, Dominique gave them a thumbnail description of his life, and then he told them with quiet conviction that God loved them tenderly and stubbornly, and that Jesus had come for rejects and outcasts just like themselves. His witness was credible because the word was enfleshed on his bones. Later, one old-timer said, the dirty jokes and vulgar language and leering at girls just stopped. One morning, Dominique failed to appear on his park bench. The men grew concerned. A few hours later, he was found dead on the floor of his cold water flat, and he died in the obscurity of a Parisian slum. Dominique Voyome never tried to impress anybody. He never wondered if his life was useful or if his witness was meaningful. He never felt he had to do something great for God. He did keep a journal. It was found shortly after his death in the drawer of the nightstand by his bed. His last entry is one of the most astonishing things I've ever read. All that is not the love of God has no meaning for me. I can truthfully say that I have no interest in anything but the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. If God wants it to, my life will be useful through my word and witness. If He wants it to, my life will bear fruit through my prayers and sacrifices. But the usefulness of my life is His concern, not mine. It would be indecent of me to worry about that. In Dominique Voyome, I saw the reality of a life lived entirely for God and for others. After an all-night prayer vigil by his friends, he was buried in an unadorned pine box in the backyard of the little brother's house in St. Remy. A simple wooden cross over his grave with the inscription, Dominique Voyome, a witness to Jesus Christ, said it all. More than 7,000 people gathered from all over Europe to attend his funeral. Thank y'all for letting me talk about storytelling.